Okay, the generation of the fathers. 110 to 156. So about 46 years here. I ended it at 156 because that's when a number of the key figures from this period die, so that seemed to be a good cutoff point. As Christian groups in many parts of the Roman world began to distance themselves from Judaism, there were important political consequences. All right, and we learned something about Pliny's correspondence with Trajan. Pliny the Younger is what we call him. His full name is Gaius Plinius Caecilius Secundus, but we'll just call him Pliny the Younger. He was a lawyer, an author, a philosopher, but he also, and more importantly for us, was governor of Pontus and Bithynia between 111 and 113 CE. Go back here. See at the very northern section of Asia Minor, Pontus and Bithynia? All right, that's where he's governor. And you see some darker shaded spots up there, see, where there's a concentration of Christians? All right. We have a whole set of exchanges of letters between him and the Roman emperor of the time, Trajan. And it's on a variety of administrative matters, but I picked out a few for you to look at that have to do with Christians. All right, and I put them in your reader. And it was in the year 112 that Pliny wrote these letters. He was faced with a dilemma. There were a number of Christians that were brought into his court. And it's unclear what the initial charges were, probably not being Christian, but they just happened to be brought there for some other reason. But he ultimately decided, despite the fact that the Christians seemed generally harmless to him, that he should execute them if they refused to recant their faith. And because he's unsure as to whether he can kill them legally, he writes to the emperor for advice. And the emperor replies, "Sounds good. You're doing the right thing. Okay? Keep doing it." But that tells us something about how the Romans are viewing Christians now. They're starting to view them as a separate people from the Jews. That's very clear. All right? They view them with suspicion. They view them as a serious enough threat that you have to execute them if they don't recant their faith. But simply saying, "I am a Christian," seemed to have been enough for Pliny to get rid of them. But he clearly says, you know, to Trajan, "I'm not going out hunting them. I'm not going looking for them. But if they happen to come into my court and they say I'm a Christian, or I'll ask them, okay, and then I deal with them as I should." New voices. There are certain persons from this time period that we should be introduced to here. Four I picked out as worthy of note. And again, we don't know that many from this time period. But let me just give you an introduction to the term fathers, because that's what these guys are, what they're called. They're often called the apostolic fathers. And I want to explain to you that term, because the original apostles are now long dead. And there were books still being written in their names and being presented as if they were written a long time ago. All right, but generally speaking, people acknowledge that the days of the apostles were over by this time. And the term apostolic fathers is popularly used to refer to the group of writings from this time, all right, the leaders of the church of this time. And all the writings from this period seem to have a similar characteristic, and that is a concern to give proper instruction, exhortation, correction to existing Christian communities regarding the way you're supposed to, you know, the proper order of church life. And the first one here is, we're not 100% sure of his existence, but Eusebius is convinced that he did exist. John the Presbyter, or we call him John the Elder, because that's what presbyter means, is an obscure figure, sometimes confused with or identified with the Apostle John, and other times not. In the New Testament, we have some writings, in particular, the second and third epistles of John, where the writer identifies himself as the presbyter or the elder. He doesn't give his name, though. this guy Papias that I'm going to tell you about in a minute from this time period. He mentions both John the Apostle. He's talking about people that he, good, upstanding church people. He mentions John the Apostle, but then he also mentions John the Presbyter separately. And Eusebius mentions this, and he takes them, they're two distinct individuals. Okay? And from what we can tell, this John the Presbyter was an important figure in Asia Minor in the early part of this period. The epistles of John, 2nd and 3rd John, and maybe even 1st John, were penned by this John the Presbyter. And Eusebius thinks for sure. So that's one guy we've got. Some people even think that perhaps he may have something to do with the Gospel of John. But again, we don't know. All right? All right, then we've got another guy. Ignatius of Antioch. That's a later painting of him. He was martyred by being thrown to the lions, so there he is playing with a couple of lions. Doesn't look like they're doing him much harm, but there he is. Antioch is in Syria, okay? Very important city early on in the Christian. Actually, it will be for quite some number of centuries. Antioch will be important in the Christian world. And he was a bishop in the church there in Antioch. We don't know anything about his life before about 113 to 115 in that area. And that's when he was arrested in Antioch. And he was sent to Rome for trial, which suggests that he was a Roman citizen. Because only citizens went to Rome for trial. And en route to Rome, he was allowed to visit Christian communities in some of the cities in Asia Minor and Greece. Then he wrote letters to these churches when he got to Rome, apparently, or while he was on the road to Rome. And we have some of these letters. So we've got actual writings from Ignatius. Taken together, they tell us a lot about the concerns of this time period. All right? He regularly gives advice, presumably out of his own experiences and based on the organization of his own church in Antioch, which he saw as a perfect example of how a church should be run. He talks all about, oh, our Antioch church is great, and you guys, you should do it the way we do it. Okay. He is the first to use the term Christianity in history. Although, technically, he doesn't use the word Christianity, he uses the word Christianism, but close enough. Okay? He shows very little awareness of many of the New Testament writings. He does know a lot about Jesus' life and death, though, and other Christian ideas, but he doesn't quote a lot from the New Testament. When he uses the word scriptures, he clearly is speaking of the Greek translation of the Old Testament. Okay? In fact, no one, up to this point still, has ever used the word scripture to refer to any New Testament writing. All right? That's still to come. He doesn't use scriptures, even from the Old Testament, as any kind of proof text, like he's trying to prove something and this scripture proves it. He just assumes that he himself is inspired to say what he does and listen to me because I know what I'm talking about. Okay? But he's very concerned over false teaching. And this is where we really see this starting to develop in the church about concerns over people teaching the wrong ideas. Okay, so he warns against Jewish ideas. All right, he sets Christianism up against Judaism as two opposing things. And one of the things we see here is that by this time it appears that the day of Christian worship is on Sunday now. So he because he puts the Sabbath and the Lord's Day, which is the day for Christian worship, as in opposition to one another, they're two separate days, Saturday, Sunday, because Sabbath is on Saturday. Originally, probably, and maybe still in Jewish Christian churches, the Sabbath was still on Saturday, but at least in his church in Antioch, no, the Lord's Day, Sunday. He doesn't like Jewish ways. So it's very much in the Hellenizer tradition. Okay. All right. Monepiscopacy is one of the things that Ignatius pushes for. He says they're using it in his church, and they should use it elsewhere. And what does it mean? What does it refer to? A single bishop in charge of one church. He basically separates the presbyters from the bishop. Okay? He says one bishop should be in charge, of the church, and then he can have a body of presbyters underneath him. So there's more of a hierarchy here. Now, he himself is the bishop of Antioch. Okay? And he talks about how that's the best way to go. Bishop in charge, presbyters under him, and then everybody else under that. Okay? That's monepiscopacy. All right, so a three-tiered church hierarchy. Bishop, presbyters, everyone else. First time we see this. Okay? Doesn't mean that everyone's doing it. And the very fact that he's telling other people to do it shows that it isn't being done everywhere. Okay, but it's our first evidence for it, and it will become the main way the church does things later on. Okay, it will be the standard. Polycarp of Smyrna. Smyrna is in Asia Minor. He was a bishop or elder there, and he hosted Ignatius on his trip to Rome. So they knew each other. Now, like other figures of this generation, Polycarp would be subject to a lot of legendary speculation later on. So the real facts of his life are somewhat clouded. The source for much of the later legend is a writing about the martyrdom of Polycarp, which took place in Smyrna in 156. That's when he died. And it's the earliest that we know of piece of martyr literature, where you actually have a passion narrative about Polycarp. And it's very much based on the passion narrative of Jesus, so that's why we don't know how much of it is true, because he's just like Jesus, you know, and how he's being martyred. Okay, but martyr literature is going to be very popular from this point forward, showing all these great figures, you know, being thrown to the lions or being crucified and all kinds of things like that. So you got the first piece of martyr literature there, the martyrdom of Polycarp. Written after his death, okay, but not too long after. There is, however, an authentic letter that Polycarp wrote. It's a letter to the Philippians. Philippi is in Greece. And in it, he gives our earliest list of qualifications for a presbyter. So that's kind of nice to know for, you know, what they were thinking, if you want to be a presbyter, how that comes about. He also speaks against Docetism, which I'm going to tell you about, and a guy named Valens, who was a member of the church that needed discipline. Anyway, an interesting thing about his letter is that he does quote from some of the works that are now in the New Testament. So Ignatius didn't really do this, but Polycarp does. He has several letters of Paul. Now, he doesn't refer to them as scripture, but he does assume they carry some authority, like, well, the Apostle Paul said this. And clearly, he's also in the Hellenizer tradition, so Paul is important to that group. If it was a Judaizer congregation, Paul's letters would not have been held in high esteem. Okay. And then we've got Papias, who was a bishop in Hierapolis, which is in Phrygia. And he was born somewhere around 70 to 75. He died about 156. Again, 156. He was, according to a later writer, from about a generation later, Irenaeus, we'll talk about him later, he was a hearer, meaning a student, of John. By John, Eusebius thinks Papias means John the presbyter. Okay? Not the Apostle John. However, others think that it might refer to the Apostle John. Okay? If it were the Apostle John would have to be pretty old. It is possible. If Papias was born around 70 to 75, it is possible maybe when he was a kid for John the Apostle, if he lived to his 80s or his 90s, maybe to have been a student. It's a bit of a stretch, though. It seems a little more likely that John the presbyter may have been his teacher. Okay? And that's what Eusebius thinks. All right? Because it's more in the right time period here. Papias wrote a book in about 130 called An Interpretation of the Sayings of the Lord in 5 books. And it doesn't exist anymore. It appears to have been a collection of the words and works of Jesus and his disciples with all kinds of explanatory matter. Now, wouldn't that be a great find? You could find that. But, alas, no. No longer in existence. However, there are fragments quoted of it in various writers, including Eusebius. He quotes from Papias. Okay? And as a matter of fact, This is what he says, Eusebius. I shall not, I don't even know if I'm using the same translation as you right now, but anyway, but I shall not regret to subjoin to my interpretations, this is Papias talking, it's from his introduction to the book, also for your benefit whatsoever I have at any time accurately ascertained and treasured up in my memory as I have received it from the elders and have recorded it in order to give additional confirmation to the truth by my testimony. For I have never, like many, delighted to hear those that tell many things, but those that teach the truth. Neither those that record foreign precepts, but those that are given from the Lord to our faith, and that came from the truth itself. By the way, this concern about truth, again, is very much from this time period, because there's so many stories now around about Jesus that conflict with one another, that people are more and more concerned about what's true. Okay? So he's saying, now I'm telling you what really happened. Okay? But if I met with anyone who had been a follower of the elders anywhere, I made it a point to inquire what were the declarations of the elders. What was said by Andrew, Peter, or Philip? What by Thomas, James, John, the apostle, Matthew, or any other of the disciples of our Lord? What was said by Aristion and the presbyter John? See how Papias seems to be clearly differentiating the two? Disciples of the Lord. For I do not think that I derived so much benefit from books as from the living voice of those that are still surviving. So Papias is claiming to have interviewed elders who knew those people. Now Eusebius claims that Papias interpreted the future millennium. Now this is from the book of Revelation. It talks about 1,000 years of the reign of Christ. Eusebius claims that Papias believed it was a physical reign of Christ on the earth and that Papias had apocalyptic ideas. All right? Not a whole lot of Christians were still into this stuff, but Papias appears to have had an apocalyptic view of the future, like the end was right around the corner and the millennium was close. But Eusebius doesn't believe in all that stuff, so he kind of criticizes Papias for that. By the way, we call that chiliasm. Here's another good word for you. I won't put it on a test. Chiliasm. It's a belief in the millennium being on the earth, okay, in the near future. Another quotation that Eusebius gives of Papias is a story about the traitor Judas Iscariot and how he died, which actually happens to be in flat contradiction of the New Testament Gospels. So that's interesting too. Okay, we'll do Docetism and then we'll call it quits. Docetism was a belief, and it had several variations, okay? But it became popular during this period, and it concerns the nature of Jesus. And it comes from a word, a Greek word, dokeo, which means to seem like something. And what it means is, the teaching is, that Jesus only appeared to have a human body. That he was not really human. He just seemed to be a human. In other words, he was a great spirit that took on the appearance of a human being when he was on the earth. Okay? Now the idea developed out of, you know, kind of a dualistic notion that viewed matter, physical world, as corrupt and the spirit as pure and wonderful. All right? And so how could you say that Jesus was corrupted by a human form, especially if you believe Jesus is God? Okay? Docetists appear to have a very high Christology, and therefore they didn't like it that Jesus would be an actual human being. That's like, ew, you know? How could a great spirit like that become a yucky human being? All right. So he didn't really suffer when he was dying on the cross because he was only a fake human. He didn't really feel pain and all that. So it was all just for show. Okay? And that would mean that the resurrection really wasn't a resurrection. It just seemed like a resurrection, because how could he die if he wasn't really a human, right? So he didn't really die. He just seemed to die, just doing it kind of to show everybody. But he was always a spirit the whole time. All right? We do not see this concept appear in any Christian writings, or even talked about in any Christian writings, until the very end of the first century. But it becomes more popular during this period. Ignatius himself writes against the Docetism. Ignatius, in one of his letters, says, "But if, as some who are godless, that is unfaithful, say, his suffering was merely an appearance. It is they who are only in appearance. Then why am I in bonds? Why do I pray also to fight the beasts? Then I am dying for no purpose. Indeed, I am lying concerning the Lord. See, so for Ignatius, and it has a lot to do with the martyrdom, if people are being martyred like Jesus, you know, they feel like they're doing what Jesus did, he's insulted by this idea, oh, Jesus didn't really suffer, why am I going through all this then? Right? It's for nothing. So he felt that was a very ungodly teaching. We also see it written about in the epistles of John, which I said we believe to be by John the Presbyter. By this you know the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesses that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, okay, is from God. And every spirit that does not confess Jesus as coming in the flesh is not from God. And this is the spirit of the Antichrist, of which you have heard that it is coming, and now it is already in the world. By the way, the term Antichrist only occurs in these letters of John. He says they have heard it before. But it refers to Docetism. He says this in 2 John. Many deceivers have gone into the world, those who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh. This is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Okay? This is an interesting thing here. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this doctrine, that is, that Jesus came in the flesh, do not receive him into the house or give him any greeting, for he who greets him shares his wicked work. The first really strong statement we have about Christians deciding not to associate with other Christians because of a false belief. Okay? And in this case, it's about these Docetists, which John and Ignatius find very offensive. Jesus came in the flesh. He was a real human being. Okay? He really suffered. And if you don't think that, we're not even going to talk to you. Okay? So that's interesting. And here's our second slide on the time period. So I have to tell you about the second Jewish revolt. I told you about the first one. Okay? And this is the second great Jewish revolt. And it's going to end the same way, unfortunately. When Hadrian... That's Hadrian up there. When Hadrian first became the Roman emperor in 118 or so, he was actually quite sympathetic toward the Jews. He allowed them to go back to Jerusalem, and he granted permission for them to rebuild their temple, which had been destroyed in the last revolt. So the expectations of the Jews were rising, and they were getting all excited, and they made organizational plans, financial preparations. And then Hadrian changed his mind. And he said, well, wait a minute. How about if you build your temple somewhere else? And that made them very mad. And he also began deporting some Jews to North Africa. And the Jews decided they wanted to rebel. But they were calmed down by a couple of their rabbis. And then they decided, well, they're going to prepare secretly for a rebellion just in case. Maybe later on, if it be necessary, we'll be ready for it. So they built all these hideouts in caves, and the Romans had them making weapons for them. It's one of their jobs. And they deliberately made the weapons very shoddily, so they weren't as good as what the Romans wanted them to be. But, I mean, they kill people, but, you know, they're just not up to Roman snuff. And they did it on purpose so that the Romans would say, oh, well, these are no good. You got to make them better. Here, you have these. And they armed themselves that way. So they got materials to make weapons, made them so that the Romans didn't want them, and then they got to keep them. Okay? And they stockpiled them and got ready for a revolt. Then around 123 or so, they began launching guerrilla attacks against the Romans. And from that point on, things just get worse. Hadrian brings in an extra army legion into Judea to deal with the guerrilla problems. And he started passing edicts to forbid the Jews from doing certain things, like he forbid circumcisions. He appointed a governor of Judea, who was a very harsh ruler, and he often took advantage of Jewish women. And about 132 or so, he began to establish a Roman-style city right at the site of Jerusalem, and he called it Aelia Capitolina, which you don't really need to know for a test, but... No. This is actually what Jerusalem's going to be known by in the future. But it's a combination of his own name with the name of the Roman god Jupiter Capitolinus. Anyway, he started to build a temple to Jupiter there. So that really got them mad. Like, oh, you wouldn't let us build our temple there, but now you're building a temple there, and it's to Jupiter. So they were very upset by that. And as long as Hadrian was in the area of Judea, because he was at the time, the Jews stayed relatively quiet. But then he left in about 132, and that's when they began their rebellion on a larger scale. And they seized all kinds of towns and fortified them with walls and dug subterranean passages under them too to hide their things and to get out. And the leader of the revolt at this time was a guy by the name of Shimon Bar Kokhba. And that's him up there. So he's the leader of the rebellion. They captured approximately 50 strongholds in the area. That's fortified strongholds, and as well as like almost 1,000 other undefended towns and villages, including Jerusalem, by the way. And Jews from other countries, because, you know, they were scattered about, came and lended their support. They even began minting coins for themselves that were, they had slogans on them like the freedom of Israel and things like that, written in Hebrew. And so Hadrian dispatched one of his governors from up north in Syria to come down to help the one he had in Judea, but the Jews defeated both of them. And then the Jews invaded the coastal regions, and the Romans had to begin some sea battles against them. So it was going poorly for the Romans initially, until, this is the turning point, Hadrian sent into Judea a man by the name of Severus. You don't have to remember him, but he was the best. Okay, and about 12 legions. That's a lot of guys from all over the place. There was a whole bunch of Jewish rebels, so this is quite a force that they have to undertake, fight against, and they were all over the place, hidden too. And there were all kinds of fortresses. So what Severus does basically is he did the slow strategy, which is you go one by one to each fortress and you starve them out. The Romans actually did suffer heavy casualties in this war, but eventually they did win out. And the final battle took place at Bar Kokhba's headquarters. And anyway, there was a council of the Jews that were there too, that were like the great rabbis of the time. And it was also a military stronghold. Thousands of Jewish refugees had fled there during the war, and now they're all in there when it's being besieged. So it's the last holdout. And there was a fierce battle, and the result was that every single Jew in the city was killed. The Romans made the Jews wait 6 days before they could bury their dead. But following that battle, there was a few other smaller skirmishes, but finally the Romans defeated all the Jews. They plowed Jerusalem with a bunch of oxen to just, you know, so there was nothing left. They sold quite a number of Jews into slavery. Many Judean settlements were not rebuilt. Jerusalem was turned into a pagan Roman city, Aelia Capitolina, and the Jews were forbidden to go there. They weren't allowed in the city. And from then on in, Hadrian discriminated against Jews and anyone like them, which would include Christians. Okay, but his worst persecution was against the Jews. He made anti-religious decrees forbidding study of the Bible and observing the Sabbath, circumcision, all the Jewish practices, meeting in synagogues even. All right, and many Jews were killed, leaders were killed, whenever the Romans felt that they were inciting any kind of, you know, resistance against the Romans. So it was not good. And Eusebius talks about this event as well in his history. Okay, the Encratites. Who are the Encratites? The word means abstainers, meaning they refrain from doing something. They abstain from something. And in particular, we're talking about the abstinence from alcohol, meat, I think any animal products, and marriage. Okay? So it's clearly ascetic in nature. But these are Christians. They're Encratite Christians. Okay? Christians who abstain. Now, were they just one special sect of Christians? Probably not. It's more like any Christian that practiced those things, you'd call them an Encratite. But there were certain churches that had Encratite tendencies. All right? But anyway, there were some that were promoting this asceticism. No meat, no alcohol, and no marriage, meaning no sex. Okay? So all that to get closer to God. We've seen this kind of stuff before. The Encratites are first mentioned by Irenaeus, who we're going to talk about in a little bit, but he's lives about 180 or so. He's writing about 180. And he says that they reject marriage, and also he says they reject the salvation of the first man. It's kind of an interesting, you'd think it would be just a little trivia detail, but he thought it was important. Meaning Adam, you know, the first man, that they believe that he would not be saved. Okay? Suggesting that Irenaeus himself believed that Adam would be saved. And he also says they proclaimed marriage to be corruption and fornication. So these people begin to be mentioned during this period, so they're a significant group of Christians. One writer says, they acknowledge what concerns God and Christ in like manner with the church, in respect, however, of their mode of life, passing their days inflated with pride. They abstain from animal food, being water drinkers and forbidding to marry. Estimated cynics rather than Christians. So some have seen that passage and they said, well, clearly then their doctrine about God or whatever was in keeping with what most people were teaching, but their difference was just in the practice, just in what they did. All right? We're not certain that that's exactly correct, but we can probably think of it that way. And we hear about them right up until the middle of the 5th century, so they're around for a while. Okay? Those are Encratites. All right, now we get into an interesting topic, the institutionalization of the church. From what we've read from this period, like the letters of Pliny and Trajan, we've at least gotten a clearer sense of Christians as a distinct religious group separate from Jews. All right, and the Romans seem to show some uncertainty about what kind of social organization they have. Were they a political faction, a private club, you know, an aid society, a foreign cult? What? I think the Romans aren't even sure at this point. But Christianity faces this dilemma of trying to define itself over and against Judaism. Like, how are we different from Jews? What exactly are we? How are we different from pagans? Okay? And they're still not even sure, because different Christians were saying slightly different things. All right? But because of these new stresses and these new situations that they have to deal with, questions are going to come up regarding authority and organization. Who is our leader or leaders? How are we supposed to be organized? Those are automatically going to be questions that arise. Now, we've already seen some people try to answer some of those questions, but still things are not settled. During this period, they're trying to settle them more than they had been in the past. All right? Remember what I told you about when certain religions first start. Okay? They rely very heavily in the beginning on the raw energy and the charisma of their founders. But as time goes on and they get larger and it's harder to control everybody, those charismatic dimensions begin to be less important and they begin to put more stress on organization, you know, rules, regulations, those kinds of things. So there's power struggles during this period. You know, who's the boss? Who should tell whom what to do? All right? And people don't merely emerge here as authority figures by virtue of their own personal qualities. Okay? Instead, more and more we're seeing them claiming to have authority because they were appointed to certain offices. I'm supposed to be your leader because I was appointed to this position. It has nothing to do with me as a person or my qualities or whatever qualifications. It's because someone made me this. And now, because I have that title, I can tell you what to do. Or, you know, some of them were even appointed originally by the group, you know. The group might have liked them at the time or whatever. But often they're claiming to have been appointed by some other authority figure. Well, so-and-so appointed me, and he was a big deal. Okay, during this period, you can't claim apostles anymore because apostles died a while ago. But you can claim to be appointed by somebody who was appointed by the apostles. Okay, and many people did that. But anyway, let's summarize some of the key factors that converge in this generation to stimulate Christianity into becoming more of an institution. Okay? First of all, some of the things I've mentioned already, like the growing separation from Judaism, and that's going to result in a need to have a distinct identity, to be different. How are we different from Judaism? That in itself is a motivation to institutionalize. And by the way, speculation about the nature of Jesus, Christology, becomes important during this period. And this is part of the process because Jews believe the Messiah is this, right? We're not Jews. So what do we think Jesus is? And there was a tendency to want to be different from the Jews instead of the same. All right? So we need to kind of redefine Jesus. And that's going to help separate them. There's a new stress on church order with regard to how you're going to do your liturgy inside the church, like our rituals. When we do our rituals in the church, how are they going to be done? Who is going to do them? What is the norm with regard to these practices? What is the norm with regard to our ethics? Right and wrong behavior. Remember things that Ignatius said, like he said when it came to baptism or the Eucharist. He says, you can't do it without the bishop being there, showing how the liturgy is tied to the authority figure. And the authority figure needs to be there to do these rituals, or else it doesn't count. So that thinking is there too. You have more and more of these fixed offices replacing the charismatic ones. All right. There was also a concern over too much diversity in theological views. All right. Well, he believes that, and I believe this, and she believes that, and they believe that, and they're all different. And they're noticing this more and more. As communications are getting better, they're still not that great, but as communications are getting better, they're realizing how many different kinds of Christians there are. And a lot of people don't like it. All right? No, no, that's wrong. You're wrong there. No, he's wrong. Okay? And one way, how do you get everyone to think similarly? You need institution to do that, right? Because if one person and another person who are equal say, oh, it's this way, no, it's that way, you're not going to get anywhere. But if you can get some leaders up there that you like and the leaders say, all right, well, we're going to believe this, then that helps. So that's why you want to institutionalize, okay? So there's a lot of talk during this period about false teachers coming and trying to lead you astray and so on and so forth. Okay, so those are some of the influences towards institutionalization. All right, hierarchy of church offices. It's in Ignatius's letters that we have for the first time explicit directions about church offices, right? He advocates the three-tiered structure, bishop on top, then you've got your group of presbyters, and then below them you've got the deacons, okay? That is monopiscopacy, as I told you before. Okay, and for him, that's the way to do it. All right, but the question is, was this already the norm in church organization? Now, Ignatius claims that there were bishops in every locality, But under what structure did they exist? Was his scheme an innovation, or did it reflect what everybody was doing? Well, the fact that he's trying to persuade people about it suggests that it's not being done everywhere, and he's trying to move it in that direction. When he is trying to persuade people, by the way, that this is the way it should be, he points out, he says, you know, he wants to let his audience know that he received this teaching by inspiration from God. So if it was already the norm, he may have said something like, well, you know, that's how it's done here and there and everywhere, and that's what everyone's doing, that's what you should be doing. He doesn't talk like that, though. He says, I know this is the right way because God told me, right? Suggesting that it's really not a majority view just yet, and he's trying to use the inspiration to show that this is the way it should be done. And so that's another reason we doubt that it was the norm. Okay, so here's what he says here. This is from one of his letters. When you are in subjection to the bishop, just as to Jesus Christ, it is clear to me that you are living not according to humans, but according to Jesus Christ, who died on account of us, so that by believing in his death, you may escape death. Therefore, it is necessary, as you also do, that you do nothing without the bishop, but be subject also to the presbytery, as to the apostles of Jesus Christ, our hope. For if we live in him, we shall be found in him. Likewise, let everyone respect the deacons as Jesus Christ, so also as the bishop is a type of the Father, and the presbyters as the council of God, and as the band of the apostles. Without them, the church cannot be called church. What he's doing here is he's saying, look, you've got God, right? He's on top. Then you've got a council of apostles, okay, that are under God, all right? Well, that's like the bishop and the presbytery. God, the apostles under him. So we're organizing our church the way God already organized things. We're just copying God. All right. That's his reason for this is the way it should be. You can only have one person on top, just like you can only have one God. We're monotheists. We should have one bishop. Okay? He also says this in another letter. It is fitting that you should live in harmony with the will of the bishop, as indeed you do, for your justly famous presbytery, this is he's talking to the Ephesians here, by the way, for your justly famous presbytery, worthy of God, is attuned to the bishop as the strings to a harp. This particular church seems to have had a single bishop in charge with a presbytery underneath. Therefore, by your concord and harmonious love, Jesus Christ is being sung. Now do each of you join in this choir, that being harmoniously in concord, you may receive the key of God in unison and sing with one voice through Jesus Christ to the Father, that he may both hear you and may recognize through your good works that you are members of his Son. So here he's saying it's like a harp, right? And you, the presbyters have to be tuned with the bishop. The bishop is like the leader of the choir or whatever. He sings, they sing along with him, all in harmony with one voice. That's how you keep the church unified. Presbyters have to follow the lead of the bishop. He even says explicitly that if you don't have a bishop around, you shouldn't even have a church meeting. Keep in mind that when he says things like that, think about this too, about the ritual of the Eucharist, for example, or baptism. Those things are beginning more and more to be thought of as a way of achieving salvation. He even calls the Eucharist the medicine of immortality. So by engaging in these rituals, you are putting yourself into a good relationship with God. All right? If you can't do them without a bishop there, then your salvation depends upon the bishop. Right? This is what, it's kind of, these are the thoughts that are being formed around this time. The bishop really is what the person that's determining or helping you to achieve your salvation with God. Now, by the middle of the second century, we find this hierarchical definition of the church order, you know, more prevalent. So it's going to become more and more and more prevalent. And there's more and more concern over false teachers and factions and how you have to get rid of the factions and so on and so forth. Okay?